Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 29th of April. We're having a hard time finding Bill McKibben, who's supposed to be joining us this hour to talk about his cover story. It's not a cover story, actually. It's announced on the cover of the Rolling Stone for April 25, the fossil fuel resistance as the world burns, a new movement to reverse climate change is emerging fiercely, loudly, and right next door. He writes that after decades of scant organized response to climate change, a powerful movement is quickly emerging around the country and around the world, building on the work of scattered frontline organizers who've been fighting the fossil fuel industry for decades. It has no great charismatic leader and no central organization. It battles on a thousand fronts, but taken together, it's now big enough to matter, and it is growing fast. We hope to find him in a moment because it's really an interesting article, and he talks about the resistance, what's happened since 43 years ago when the first Earth Day grew 20 million people into the streets and we got some new legislation. Now, because of the Keystone protests, there are organizations that are actively involved, but most importantly, there are people who are involved, and it's not run by the parties or really taken up very much by the parties, but an important issue, and so we had hoped to talk to him. I really don't want to do an open line on this issue because I want him to guide us through this rather than just hear everybody talk about this issue. So we hope we'll be able to find him in just a moment, but we don't know where he is right now. So what'll we do? Well, first let me just say this, that Thursday, this is a story that I think is very important, and there are a lot of connections here between what we buy in the West and those countries that have and those countries that have not. Charlie Kernaghan is going to be with us on Thursday. We used to have Charlie on years ago, but the garment factories in Bangladesh, we're going to be talking about the conditions under which people who are very poor work, and that horrendous story, and it's on the heels of another horrendous story of a fire in one of those garment factories. So we're going to look at the whole issue of why these buildings are so horrible, why people make no money, why child labor is used, and it's not just in Bangladesh, it's in other parts of the world as well. So Charlie will be with us. He's been living in those parts of the world for a number of years and has been very concerned about the issue. And I think you'll find it, you know, it's one of those important issues to talk about that's not widely talked about. He'll be with us on Thursday of this week. So that's coming up. And we're trying to get, all right, Bill McKibben is trying to get to a phone. So we've found him. He's out somewhere where there may not be a lot of phones, but we hope that we'll be able to get him. Oh, he's in Walla Walla, Washington. So he'll find a phone and be with us momentarily to talk about his piece in Rolling Stone. What else is coming up this week? Let me see. Well, maybe Rhonda can let me know. I'm not sure. I'm in the moment. We have a one-day pledge drive on Wednesday. Thanks, Rhonda. And it's important. I like these one-day things because they don't go on and on. They're done, and you make the money you hope, and then you move on to full hours. So that's on Wednesday. I do hope that you will pledge on that day, and it's an important thing to do if you're a public radio supporter. And we're going to be playing during one of the hours some of the more remarkable interviews, and we've had lots of them, but we'll play some of the more remarkable interviews that we've had, and that will be one of our hours on Wednesday. So here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, and Bill will just try to find a phone, and so we hope to be having him with us in a moment. I can give you at least the intro for Bill, hoping that he'll join us momentarily. Bill McKibben is an author, an educator, and an environmentalist. He has written a number of books about the environment, starting with The End of Nature in 1989, regarded as the first book for a general audience on climate change. He's a founder of the grassroots climate campaign 350.org, which has organized, get this, 15,000 rallies in 189 countries since 2009. Time magazine called him the planet's best green journalist. The Boston Globe has said he was probably the country's most important environmentalist. He is a distinguished scholar at Middlebury College, and he is author of, well, 12 books. It's a lot of books, right? Hope, Human and Wild, Long Distance, A Year of Living Strenuously, about a year that he spent training for endurance events at an elite level. He published Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future, and many other books. And we hope that he will be with us momentarily. And we'll be welcoming your phone calls about this important issue. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page, if you would like to leave messages there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We got him. Okay. The piece that we're talking about, the fossil fuel resistance as the world burns, a new movement to reverse climate change is emerging fiercely, loudly, and right next door. It's in the current issue of the Rolling Stone. Bill McKibben, thank you very much for being with us.
Brent, it's a pleasure as always. How are you?
Well, I am fine. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm a little tired. I confess I preached yesterday at Riverside Church in New York and then flew to Seattle to give a talk with the mayor last night, who's just announced that the city of Seattle will divest its fossil fuel stocks. And now
Whoa.
I'm in beautiful Walla Walla, Washington, the home of Whitman College. And meanwhile, I've just heard over the internet that we have the first president's office sit-in of the divestment movement underway in Rhode Island. So I'm this fossil fuel resistance that you describe is breaking out literally from one corner of the country to the other, and even as we speak.
Well, I guess you're a pretty busy guy. It's amazing where you've been in the last 24 hours. So tell me what Seattle did. I have not heard that story. That's interesting.
Seattle, we've launched this campaign, one of many campaigns that we're working on, to get big institutions to divest their funds from fossil fuel companies. And mostly we were aimed at the beginning at colleges and universities, and there are 340 colleges and universities that have active divestment fights underway. But we also asked cities and towns if they would do the same thing. During the apartheid era, dozens of cities and state governments divested their funds from companies that were doing business with that racist government.
Mm-hmm.
So the very first to step up was Seattle. Mayor McGinn said a few weeks ago, you know, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars building seawalls. Why would we be investing in the companies that make this necessary?
Hmm.
And since that time, 11 other cities have followed suit. It's going much, much faster than we would have expected and very, very exciting.
And why is that? Is it because of of Sandy? Is it because of hurricanes? Is it because of droughts? Are we just witnessing a lot more effects of global climate change, Bill?
I think you've got it pretty much exactly right. Over 85% of American counties have experienced a federally declared weather disaster in the last 2 years.
Goodness.
That's why I think public opinion has spiked very sharply in the direction of being worried about climate change. At the same time, people have noticed, finally, that our system has done nothing to respond, that we've had a 25-year bipartisan record of accomplishing essentially nothing in Washington. And I think they're beginning to understand why. The financial power of the fossil fuel industry is so great that it simply can't, at the moment, you can't get anything even mildly sensible out of Congress. And so we're going to have to try and weaken that industry some. And that's a big part of what this divestment movement is about. It's worked really once in American history. That was around South Africa.
Yes.
And, you know, when Nelson Mandela got out of prison, the first place he came was to the University of California to say thank you to students for forcing the divestiture of stock. He said, we fought for our own liberation, obviously, but in a globally linked world, we couldn't do it by ourselves. And that's why his colleague, Desmond Tutu, the great South African churchman, put out a video appeal to Americans to join this divestment again this time around. He said, if you could see what's happening in Africa with famine and drought, then you'd know why we're asking you to pick up these tools again after a quarter century. And it's been very inspiring to see it starting to happen. Still early days, but so many campuses and now many faith communities too, beginning the divesting process, and it's spreading around the world. Just last week, the largest Protestant denomination in Australia announced that they were divesting. And that's quite remarkable given the power of the coal industry in Australia. Mm-hmm. So I think we're seeing remarkable change.
And yet you outline in the Rolling Stone piece what you're fighting against. And these are no small things you're fighting against. You write, there are trillions of dollars worth of oil in Canada's tar sands and the North Dakota shale. The men who own the coal mines and the gas wells will spend what they need to assure their victories.
The CEO of Exxon, a man named Rex Tillerson, went on Charlie Rose the other night, and Charlie Rose leaned in and asked him that avuncular softball question. He said, tell me, what's your philosophy? Clearly not a great philosopher, but someone you'd expect would come up with something. You know, we're working to help the world with its energy needs or something. And he just looked straight in the camera and said, my philosophy is to make money. And indeed, Exxon has made more money than any company in the history of money. The problem is they and their compatriots have done it by filling the atmosphere with so much carbon that the Arctic is now 80% melted, that the ocean is now 30% more acidic than it was 40 years ago, that the atmosphere itself, because warm air holds more water vapor than cold, is 5% better than it was, leading to this increase in downpour and in drought. We're in a tough way already, and the scientists who told us what would happen so far tell us it's going to get much worse unless we leave in the ground most of the coal, four-fifths of the coal and gas and oil that these guys already have in their reserves. If they carry out their business plan, there's no longer any mystery about what happens. The planet tanks. So we have to change that. We have to put a price on carbon, which economists have said all along is the easiest, most efficient way to keep it from flowing into the atmosphere. But we can't put that price on carbon as long as the fossil fuel industry owns Washington and so many other capitals. So we fight for divestment. We play defense, too. We fight things like the Keystone Pipeline, or the coal ports that they want to build in the Pacific Northwest, or mountaintop removal coal mining, which is an abomination, or the quick shift to fracking to find us a whole new set of fossil fuels to be dependent on. It's all craziness, and that's why it's good news that this resistance is rising right now.
What's the status right now, Bill, of the Keystone Pipeline?
Well, the status is, as it's been all along, sort of up in the air. You know, everybody thought this was a done deal in 2011 when we started trying to do a little opposition to it, and that opposition mushroomed. We had the largest civil disobedience action in 30 years on any issue, 1,250-some people arrested. And then the president took a year's delay, and that delay is now over, and so the State Department is finishing up a environmental impact statement. We had a million public comments that were delivered last week against Keystone XL to the State Department. Maybe the most important was the millionth and one, which came from the EPA in their official comments, saying that the State Department had completely missed the boat in their evaluation of this project and needed to go back and start again. Once the State Department says, says what it's going to say, then President Obama gets to decide if the whole thing is in the national interest or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be interesting to see. Mm-hmm. This is the closest thing he's going to get to a free shot here. He doesn't have to ask Congress. He can decide yay or nay by himself. And it'll be the test of whether he wants a climate legacy or not. If he does the right thing, he'll be the first world leader able to say, I blocked a big project on climate grounds. That'll provide him a legacy. More importantly, it'll provide him a bargaining chip as he goes back to international negotiations.
Interesting. Well, there are those, though, of course, you've heard this, who will say that environmentalists lobbied so effectively that it was put on hold for a year. He also faced re-election here, so maybe politically it was the right thing to do to put this on hold for a year. And but the pressure from the industry is so strong that he's not likely to really act on this.
The pressure from the industry is incredibly strong and incredibly relentless. That's what happens when you have that much money.
Right.
That's why the pressure from the other side on, you know, if we lose the fight over Keystone, we're not going away. If anything, it will kind of show the logic of what we've been saying, that if the fossil fuel industry is so strong that they can force our most progressive president that we could probably imagine into approving a dog like the Keystone Pipeline, then it's all the more proof that we have to go outside government and figure out ways to really reduce their power with things like divestment.
Let's talk a little bit about renewable energy. You write in the article, it's a technology that's gone from pie in the sky to panel on the roof in remarkably short order. We don't hear very much, Bill, about what the state of that industry is. And you also mentioned places like Germany, which has been able to use solar power quite effectively. And who thinks in Germany they can use solar power? Is there a lot of money being invested in this? Are we moving ahead rapidly?
There's a lot of money being invested in it in Germany.
Ah.
There are more solar panels in Bavaria than there are in the United States.
No. Really?
Think about that for a minute.
Huh.
The Germans, there were days last summer when the Germans generated half the power they used from solar panels within their borders. And this from a country, you know, Munich is north of Montreal. Think what you might be able to do. If your country had, say, California, Texas, Florida, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, people are putting up solar panels in this country, but they're not doing them at a pace that will make much difference to climate change. We need a far greater commitment and far speedier action. And what places like Germany prove is that it's not technological ability that we lack, it's political will. And hopefully we can muster that. That's why that's another of these tasks of this fossil fuel resistance. And it's really fun to watch, people starting to learn how to do it, at least on a small scale. Our friends at a group called Solar Mosaic have figured out how to crowdsource funding for solar projects on community centers and public housing projects and things. And people get good returns and the things get built. It's really quite wonderful to watch.
You talk about a December study from the University of Delaware showing that by 2030, we could affordably power the nation 99.9% of the time on renewable energy.
That's right. What they studied, if we built this out quickly, they studied 50 million weather conditions, or 50 billion, I think, weather conditions. And what they found was that you could keep the lights on. If you built out sun and wind, you'd be fine.
Let's welcome phone calls for you, Bill. I hope we're not having a phone problem here. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Bill McKibben is our guest this hour, author, educator, environmentalist, founder of the grassroots climate campaign 350.org. And we're talking to him now because of the piece that's in the current issue of the Rolling Stone. And it's the fossil fuel resistance as the world burns, a new movement to reverse climate change is emerging fiercely, loudly, and right next door. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Bill McKibben. Let's start with Julie in Milwaukee. Hi, Julie.
Oh, hi, Kathleen. I'm calling as a member of the local 350.org chapter here in Milwaukee. And we've been working for the last few months, and we're not only working on divestment issues, but also the Keystone Pipeline, and have sent busloads out to D.C. for the big demonstration in February. And people who went to testify from Wisconsin in Nevada just this past, Nebraska just this past week. But also we've had lots of people coming forward wanting to get involved, and a lot of concern that President Obama may cave in to the big money on this Keystone Pipeline issue. And if he does, question is, then what? We've done all of these things, huge activism across the country, and I know there's civil disobedience going on down in Texas along the pipeline route. So, Bill, do you call for more massive civil disobedience, or what is the reaction going to be if Obama actually caves in?
I think the reaction is, as you described, it won't put away the movement. The movement may grow, but it'll be the chance for a kind of unified movement that stretches from the White House down to the streets will be gone, and they'll have a kind of bitter, fragmented, somewhat cynical movement, which is okay. I mean, if that's reality, then that's reality, and we need to deal with it. And we'll continue fighting Keystone, though it'll be hard, but we'll be, I'm sure, out in Nebraska and whatever getting arrested. But we'll also move the fight in 100 other directions, too. In fact, we'll do it even before the Keystone decision. Keep track of 350.org in the next couple of weeks. We're now about to announce a kind of summer offensive. We're calling it Summer Heat. The last 10 days of July are the traditionally, statistically, the hottest days of the summer. We've sort of trying to make them politically hot this year, too. And there'll be opportunities for the many, many people in many regions of the country who really are ready to step up their activism. And I got to say, I have no doubts about Wisconsin. The Milwaukee 350 people are great, and for me, one of the highlights of the whole year was getting to come up and give a couple of talks in Hayward, and then ski the Berkey the next day with lots and lots and lots of people who were fighting for the sort of cool planet skiers, they were calling themselves, and it was great fun on a glorious day, and I hope I get to do it again before long.
Thank you very much, Julie, for your call. Lou in Cudahy, hi.
Hi, this is Leftist Ideology on Parade. The only legacy Obama's going to have after he's given all this millions of dollars to these failed solar companies is that, as he said, utility prices aren't necessarily going to skyrocket, especially when you consider the shutting down of the coal industry. I wonder what the guests would say about the East Anglia University, the climate reporting unit over there, and those 1,000 leaked emails that showed these researchers cherry-picking and picking data that agreed with their political objective, essentially presenting advocacy science as something that's true and scientific.
You don't believe in global warming, Lou?
Do I believe in it?
Yeah.
No, well, there's hundreds of scientists who have spoken out against it, and some of the original founders have walked away from the environmental movement.
Bill.
Well, I guess what I'd say, first of all, about the East Anglia, the stolen emails and things, was that there have now been three independent investigations of it, and all of them have concluded that nothing in them casts any doubt on the basic science of global warming, or indeed on the propriety of the people involved. The truth is, at this point, to believe in some conspiracy, you have to be a conspiracy theorist of the highest order, because somehow, not only did they manage to get every scientist in the planet on board this conspiracy, they managed to convince the Arctic sea ice to melt. And the conspirators managed somehow to persuade the ocean to absorb enough carbon that its waters became 30% more acidic. I wrote the first book on all this 25 years ago, a book called The End of Nature. And I can tell you that what scientists were predicting then is precisely what's happened so far, except that it's come harder and faster than we thought. Scientists have underestimated the effects of climate change almost from the beginning, and that's because scientists are conservative by nature. And the people who style themselves as conservatives at this point, perhaps like your caller, are anything but conservative. They're engaged in the most radical experiment that humans have yet undertaken. And it's up to those of us who, after all, are asking only for a world a little bit like the one we were born onto, to actually act as conservatives in this case, to try and put a brake on this radical experimentation that goes with altering the chemistry of the atmosphere.
George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Yeah, hi. I know one of the things that people criticize about a lot of alternative energy sources like solar and wind is that you still need to have some kind of backup for times when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing. I wonder if Mr. McKibben could talk a little bit about the state of the art in terms of storing energy.
Yeah, electricity storage is, if there are any, you know, young engineers in the audience looking for something, a life's project to work on, advanced energy storage would be a good one. It would help a lot. The good news is that we're learning how to use the grid itself as a kind of storage medium. And that's what that Delaware study found. What you need to do is overbuild somewhat the number of solar panels for kind of ideal sunny conditions and wind turbines and things. And if you do, if you build them out some extra at a completely affordable cost, they found, that would provide 99.9% coverage. We're also starting to figure out how to use the grid in other interesting ways. For instance, as more people bring electric or hybrid electric vehicles online, like I have one, and it's plugged in now in my garage, in fact, basically plugged into the solar panels on my roof. But since we're on the grid, it means that, in essence, my car can become a battery storage device for the grid. And at moments when the grid needs it, it would be completely feasible to withdraw power from the battery in that car. And you can see how when you scale this out enough, it works just fine. It's just a different model. Instead of having big centralized energy production systems, you know, few big coal-fired power plants in your state pushing electrons at you, you'd have a very dispersed, diffuse, spread out grid. So think about the difference, say, with think about the difference between the broadcast television paradigm that we grew up with, three channels pushing stuff at us, and then think about the internet, you know, a million nodes, everybody putting in and taking out. That's the kind of change that we're seeing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's great that you have a car, and I have a nice car, and we live in relative affluence in the parts of the country that we do. But let's shift, and you do in your article, to much of the world that is absolutely dirt poor, and you talk about this much harder goal to leapfrog the fossil fuel age and go straight to renewables. Is that happening at all? I mean, this is a difficult issue.
Well, the answer is yes and no. There are places like China that are actually leading the world now in renewable energy, but they're also putting up lots and lots of coal-fired power plants.
Mm-hmm.
That's the cheapest thing to do. Here's the deal, really, if you think about it. The rich world, in large measure, got rich by burning fossil fuel.
Yeah.
They filled the atmosphere with so much carbon that there's no room for the poor countries to do the same thing, to emulate what they did. And so that means that the poor countries, for both practical and moral reasons, deserve our assistance, largely in terms of technology, in leapfrogging, making that leapfrog, in doing with energy what they did with telecommunications. They went straight from no telephones to cell phones without the landlines in between. You could go straight from wood fires to solar panels without the huge power station thing in between, but it's expensive enough that they're going to need real help from the world to do that. And they deserve it, and the world would be wise to give it, because it doesn't make any difference where the carbon comes from in the atmosphere. We're going to feel its effects if it comes from India or Wisconsin.
George, thanks so much for your call. Email from Kurt, can you respond to the criticism levied by Joe Nocera in the New York Times that extracting tar sands oil is not that much dirtier than other sources and that Canada will simply sell it elsewhere if it doesn't sell it to the United States?
Sure. I agree with the Times editorial board, which came up very forthrightly against the Keystone Pipeline, and actually with Tom Friedman at the Times, who did the same thing. It's very clear that this is the dirtiest energy on Earth, but even if it was just exactly the same as any other crude oil, not this sludgy tar sand stuff, the real problem is there's just too much of it. If you could burn everything in Alberta tonight, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 would go from its current 400 parts per million, already too high, to 540 parts per million. Meanwhile, the argument that Canada is just going to sell it someplace else runs into the obstacle of the map. Now, Alberta is landlocked. They threatened 2 years ago, said, oh, we'll put a pipeline through to the west coast of Canada and just send it to Asia that way. But that pipeline is completely dead. It is blocked by great activists across British Columbia who are not going to let that pipeline get built. They don't want hundreds of oil tankers cruising the coast. And it's been blocked by First Nations people.
Hmm.
And so at this point, Canada is asking us to be the throughway for its oil so it can send it to the Gulf Coast and get sent off around the world. As the leader of the Canadian opposition, the NDP party, said when he was in Washington a couple of weeks ago, he said the Canadians are playing Obama for a fool. And in this case, I think they're trying to. I hope he won't oblige.
Hmm. Daryl is next in Grant County. Hi, Daryl.
Hi. Well, this is a worldwide problem, and of course, Germany is leading the way. They're the best example that I know of right now. But investing in energy efficiency and renewable energy is the most cost-effective and the best payout over the long term that you can have in the United States of America or around the globe. And we got to have elected leaders like Obama, the Democratic Party, and even the Republicans. They've got to wise up and speak to the media. And then if you get media broadcasting globally and doing the best examples of energy saving. I worked in the air conditioning business since the mid-1970s. And there is horrible waste yet in the heating and air conditioning industry. And homes, a lot of homes are not nearly efficient enough. There's a tremendous amount we can do there, but it's a matter of education. People have to be informed. Now, people think they know it all, but there's a whole lot you don't, and even you don't know a lot of these things that are involved in heat and air. You have to be a real tech specialist in those areas, in those fields, or you won't realize what's going on. Actually, even new high-efficiency equipment can only deliver a lot of times half of what it's supposed to, because of the duct system and stuff on split systems. But anyway, we need Obama. We need the broadcasters. Like there's $3.4 trillion in the baby boomer generation. And then there's the Gen Xers, and they got, they got nearly that much in that generation. And there's money available in the private sector. We can do it all in the private sector, and it'll build the economy, and the multiplier effect will kick in, and, man, I mean, it'll change the whole future.
Bill.
I think that's just right. And one of the things to really note about what we can do with renewable energy and conservation is that in the course of doing it, it will create an awful lot of jobs. Think about the tasks of things like insulating your home or putting a solar panel on top or doing the duct work that the caller describes. Very few people, my prediction, are going to put their house on a boat and send it to China to get it done. It's got to be done here by Americans who know how to swing hammers. And that's, you know, it would be an enormous boost to our economy if we got around to it.
I don't fully understand, Bill, why it is, considering what's happened in the country and that the president seems to be mentioning global climate change. It seems to be somewhat on board with this. There are some members of Congress who are on board with this. We've had all these horrendous events in the United States. Why is it that it's so hard for this to become a political issue? You would think that politicians would want to move in the direction of renewable energy.
Well, you would think, but and a few do. But, you know, look at the president last year during the election campaign. He was very, very weak on any of this. He didn't mention climate change, even though it was by far the warmest year in American history.
Right.
Not until after Sandy, in the last few days of the election, was it sort of safe for him to do it. Instead, he talked endlessly about his all-of-the-above energy policy, that he was for every kind of energy, coal, gas, oil, sun, wind.
Right.
Which, if you think about it, is the same thing as not having a policy. I mean, if the president got up and said, we have an all-of-the-above foreign policy. We think North Korea and Britain are just as good as each other, you know, and we like them all equally. People would look somewhat askance at that, I think. But in this case, because of the incredible financial power of the fossil fuel industry, that's just what happens in Washington, and that's why we've got to change that power.
Thanks, Daryl. Joanne in Jacksonport. Hi.
Hi. This is a wonderful discussion. Tar sands mining is horribly dirty, and I understand that it has destroyed about 20 square miles of beautiful forest land in Canada. And I think we've seen the pipelines leaking in these cities, one in Mississippi or wherever that one goes down south.
Arkansas,
they don't know how
yes.
to even clean it up when it leaks. And unfortunately, we here in Wisconsin are contributing to it because they are energetically mining the sand dunes in the western part of the United States. And some of the local legislators are trying valiantly to at least make the permitting process really difficult. And yet there's lots of people in our state that don't even know that that's happening.
That's right. They need that sand in order to effectively frack. And so in a weird way, Wisconsin is on the front lines of some of this itself. The stuff about the leaks is absolutely right. People should, anybody who has any, anybody wants to see a particularly remarkable video from a couple of weeks ago should just Google Mayflower, Arkansas oil spill.
I'm sorry,
see what happened?
Mayflower?
Mayflower, Arkansas. Mayflower, Arkansas oil spill.
Okay.
You'll see, what you'll see is a suburb that looks so perfectly like a perfect American subdivision that you'd think it was sort of built by Hollywood. And then suddenly a tar sands pipeline breaks open and there is a river, and I mean river, of oil flowing through this place. They have to evacuate everyone. They're going to have to, I think Exxon's going to end up buying the houses probably. It was horrible to see, and it's led people sick, and Exxon made sure that no one, the reporters couldn't get, threatened to arrest reporters at one point for trying to go cover it. But word got out. That's what happens now in the internet Twitter age, you know, and it's astonishing to see.
Thanks, Joanne, very much for your call. More phone calls in a moment. Bill McKibben is our guest this hour. He is author, educator, environmentalist, founder of the Grassroots Climate Campaign 350.org, and author of a number of books. His piece in the Rolling Stone caught our attention. It's this week's issue, The Fossil Fuel Resistance. As the world burns, a new movement to reverse climate change is emerging fiercely, loudly, and right next door. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill McKibben is our guest. Bill, can you spend more time, as you do in the article, talking about this resistance movement? You highlight the fossil fuel resistance, the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization. Some of what's happening, and you can't, there are thousands of such actions, but I don't think we're very aware of what groups of people are doing all over the country.
Yes, and much of the leadership's coming from what you would call the climate justice or environmental justice movement, because, you know, this trouble isn't visited equally on all of us. I mean, climate change, in a sense, is, although even there the poor get hit first and worst. But, you know, we put power plants and things in places where poor people live.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the ones who pay with asthma and whatever else. So they're the ones who've taken the lead for a long time. And now it's helpful, I think, that the rest of us are arriving as kind of reinforcements for this effort. The people who've really been leading the fight the longest and most effectively are indigenous activists, and they've done a great job, it must be said. They're the people we work with maybe the most of all, and to watch across North America their growing militance and power makes me very happy.
Let's go to Gary in Ripon. Hi, Gary.
Hello. I don't doubt that global warming or climate change is happening. I just don't see how you're going to get anywhere near a significant number of people to give up driving vehicles or give up air conditioning or iPads to alleviate that.
Yeah, I think that all those things are unlikely, so I think what we need to do is figure out how to power the iPad and the car in some way that doesn't heat up the atmosphere. And the good news is that we know what the future looks like. I think everybody knows that 50 or 100 years from now, we'll be using sun and wind to power our lives. The question is, can we do it in 10 or 20 years if, you know, in the time that physics is allowing us to deal with climate change? I wish we had more time. It would be cheaper and easier and less traumatic to do it slowly. But our adversary here is, you know, it's not really industry versus environment or Republicans versus Democrats or things. It's human beings versus physics. And physics is a poor negotiating partner. You know, we've got to do what it tells us to do, in essence.
We go to Jennifer in Milwaukee next. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thank you for putting me on the air. Much of my sentiment was brought up by a previous caller, but as I've been listening to the show, I've been so frustrated with callers that are unwilling to acknowledge the millions of dollars that are spent each year in our country cleaning up oil spills and the environmental impact from continuing to rely on this form of energy. And it just makes me laugh to think about what sort of environmental impact or expense would need to be incurred for a solar panel on everybody's roof, or what is the cost associated with erecting wind turbines across the state. And it just makes no sense to me to continue in the way that we are and not be more aggressive in adopting alternative forms of energy. So it's an excellent discussion, and I just wish more people who needed to hear it would be listening.
Thank you for the call, Jennifer. Bill?
I think that's absolutely right. And one of the points that's important to keep in mind, and that she implicitly does, is that there's an enormous cost to not doing things. You know, the one big economic analysis of climate change indicated that by mid-century, it would be as expensive, unchecked, as World War I, World War II, and the Great Depression combined. You know, so when someone tells you it's too expensive to put up solar panels, ask them how expensive they think it's going to be to deal with rapidly rising sea levels, year after year of Midwest drought, horrendous floods. You know, we watched Superstorm Sandy, the lowest barometric pressure ever recorded north of Cape Hatteras. We watched it pour salt water in the New York City subway system. You want a kind of metaphor for the fragility of our civilization? That would seem to provide it.
Well, what about all the money that those kinds of storms cost and having to redesign and rebuild a whole city's infrastructure? If you get hit with another one of those, you're talking billions and billions of dollars. Doesn't that change the trajectory here?
Well, it does for people who are thinking about it. That's why the mayor of Seattle and now the mayors of 11 other cities have said we're divesting.
Yeah.
But it doesn't for the fossil fuel industry. If your whole take on the world is my philosophy is to make money, then what do you care? I mean, the CEO of Exxon said last summer, said, yeah, it's true, global warming's real, but we'll just deal with it. And someone said, what do you mean deal with it? He said, well, if we have to move our crop production areas, then we will. I mean, that's almost literally insane thing to say. Crop production areas are what people call farms, normal people. And we already have them everywhere that we have soil. You know, it's true that Exxon's melting the tundra, but that doesn't mean you can just move, you know, Iowa and its cornfields or Wisconsin and its dairies up there to Siberia. I mean, there's no soil. The corn won't stand up. The cows will stagger. What we've got to do is instead change the practices of one industry, the energy industry, not make the entire rest of the world bow to their need for more profit.
Let's go next to Willem and Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. One of the things that was brought up was our political leadership. And I remember, I'm 62 years old, and I remember in the late 70s when Jimmy Carter had put solar panels on the White House, and one of the first things that Ronald Reagan did when he took office was remove those solar panels, effectively setting back our opportunity to further solar and things like that by at least 30 years. And in our state, the political leadership is in favor of frac sand mining, but they're opposed to, they make it difficult for wind turbines to be sited with a 1,500-foot set-aside from a property line, yet someone can build a sand mine right across the street from my house, and there's so much fuel, diesel fuel, used in moving this sand, and then the whole fracking process, and I was wondering if you could address some of those things, and what's called the Halliburton loophole, which makes it impossible for citizens to find out what these chemicals are that are being rammed into our fuel, and the deflocculants used in Wisconsin to sort out.
Yes, no, all these things are all these things are absolutely right. I mean, the solar panels on the White House are a particularly acute example. I was in China not long ago doing a piece for National Geographic and spending the day with the headquarters of the largest solar hot water company on the planet. And the founder had in his private museum one of those solar panels that Jimmy Carter had put on the White House.
Oh, really?
And Ronald Reagan taken down. This is, you know, this industry provides solar hot water, you know, uses the sun to heat hot water for about 250 million Chinese, about 25% of the country. In our country, we use it for less than 1% of homes, and even most of those are to heat swimming pools. So you get some sense of, I mean, we knew how to do this 35 years ago. We knew how to do this before we even knew there was global warming. We've just been so captured by the fossil fuel industry that we don't do it.
Thanks, Willem, so much for the call. Let's go next to Matt in Wausau. Hi, Matt.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Just a couple of quick points. I've heard talk that if the average car in America got 30 miles or better to the gallon, we wouldn't need to import foreign oil. I don't know how accurate that is, but I'm wondering why Ford makes a model of the Fiesta, I believe it is, a three-cylinder diesel that gets upwards of over 50 miles to the gallon and burns quite cleanly. Why aren't those available in the United States, and why, as we transition to other types of fuel, aren't we concentrating more on fuel efficiency in the vehicles that we do have now? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for the call.
Fuel efficiency is the one place where I think the Obama administration deserves at least decent marks. It's the one thing they did, and it was because the car industry was so on the ropes in the early days of the Obama administration. You may recall that basically the federal government owned them, that they were able to push these things through without the usual opposition from Detroit. And it's a kind of reminder of why we need to divest and weaken the fossil fuel industry some so that we'll be able to do some of the same things there. Car mileage will be getting better, not as fast as it should or could, but at least we've taken, that's the one place we've taken small steps. Meanwhile, just news update for you. I've just been told that there are 11 students occupying the president's office at the Rhode Island School of Design in an effort to force divestment. They are very brave students, just like the people on 340 other campuses that are engaged in this work, including a bunch in Wisconsin.
Hmm.
And so it's really good to watch young people standing up for their future, saying, we're actually not going to let old people like boards of trustees deflect us any longer. We want a future. We want a planet as nice as the ones you guys had. So don't get in the way of that. And I'm very grateful to them.
Thanks, Matt, for your call. One more call. Carl in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I am in no way endorsing this, but I've read a handful of articles extolling the virtues of using nuclear reactors. Now, these are smaller than the tiny refrigerator-sized ones that are used on nuclear submarines to crack water directly, not first converting to steam and then using that heat. What is the drawback to this if it's something other than nuclear?
Well, I don't think nuclear power is going to play a big role just because it's too expensive. I mean, it just, you know, this is, you might as well burn $20 bills to generate electricity. And post-Fukushima, I don't think anyone's going to let it get done near them, is my guess. Take a better organizer than me to get it out there. I think we know the technologies that we need. They're renewable, they're plentiful, they're widespread. We just got to get to work on them. And you know, the problem with them, as opposed to even the nuclear, is that you can't make, if you're a big industrialist, you can't make quite as much money. you can make some money, but you got to share it with the guys who are going to put up the solar panels. And once the solar panels are up, from Exxon's point of view, what really stinks is you can't meter the sun. You know?
Bill, thank you ever so much for being with us this hour. It was a fascinating conversation, and it's good to know what's going on in the country that we're just not as aware of as we ought to be, probably.
Yes, people should just keep those kids in Rhode Island in your prayers today, please.
Bill McKibben, our guest this hour. Bill is an author, an educator, an environmentalist. He has been called by Time Magazine the planet's best green journalist, and the Boston Globe said he's probably the country's most important environmentalist. In the story we talked about, well, he's written a lot of books, but he's written a piece. He mentioned that divestment movement. He writes about it extensively in the current issue of the Rolling Stone. The fossil fuel resistance as the world burns, a new movement to reverse climate change is emerging fiercely, loudly, and right next door. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program, and thanks for your calls, everybody. Until tomorrow, great conversations ahead.